Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. The Caped Crusader, Die Fledermaus, Dracula's convenient way of getting around. Those are some of the pop culture references that may come to mind when you hear the word bat. Pest may be another word if you've ever encountered bats in a place where you did not want them, like your attic. But bats are found all over the world, except in polar regions. There are over 1,200 bat species, and together they're the only mammals capable of true flight. Bats have their own problems, though, and one of them is a fungal disease that's been decimating the bat species that are susceptible to it. Scientists still don't know much about white nose syndrome, except that it's become an urgent problem for bats and, indirectly, us. Our guest on Focus today knows about bats and their problems. He's Ed Heskey, a mammalian ecologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey, part of the Prairie Research Institute at the U of I, based here on the U of I Urbana campus. Ed, welcome to Focus.
Thank you.
And we'll be talking a lot about a particular disease facing bats today. That's white nose syndrome. I understand you're part of a project that's looking at this problem.
Yeah. White nose syndrome is a really interesting but also really scary disease. It was first detected in 2006 in a cave in upstate New York, where some cavers actually took a picture of some bats that had looked like they had been hit in the face with a sugar donut or something. They had a powdery looking fungus growing on their faces. That's why the disease is called white nose syndrome, because it's a fungus that grows on the bats' faces. This was kind of a cave that was visited by a lot of tourists in the summer, like has tens of thousands of visitors per year and stuff. And it was kind of an unusual thing that showed up. But by the next year, in bat hibernacula around the Albany area in New York, this phenomenon was showing up in bats in these hibernacula, and we started to see mass mortalities of bats. And then every year since then, the disease has spread further north, further west, until just this March, we reported it for the first time.
This
in Illinois.
March, this month.
This month.
So it's just really just a few weeks or so that we've been aware of it here.
Well, that we've reported it confirmed. Our study knew it was coming here because it's been spreading west every year, and we were on the leading edge here in Illinois. So I'm part of a team of people I'll talk about in a little bit. But we've been surveying some well-known bat hibernacula throughout the state of Illinois. We surveyed last year and found no evidence of it, no symptomatic bats, and we also sampled the environment for the fungus and found no evidence. But this year we did. And so we haven't seen the mass mortalities yet in Illinois. We've only seen a few symptomatic bats here or there. But the disease tends to operate on a 3 to 4 year cycle, so that you detect it, then you get maybe 20% mortality, and then it's the third and fourth year when you start seeing the real severe impacts.
So it's not an instant. Well, once a bat is infected, I mean, does that bat have long to live, or do we know?
Yeah, we kind of do know. What happens is, this is a disease that we now know from, we didn't at the start, but we now know that it's actually caused by an invasive fungus, okay? The fungus is called the Geomyces destructans. It's a new fungus known to science that we just discovered because of this disease.
Has it only been found in North America, or does it exist elsewhere on the world?
No. Now that we know what to look for, that we've identified the disease here, we've gone back and they found it in several places throughout Europe. So, for example, it's been found in Great Britain, it's been found in Germany, France, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary. But we don't really know its worldwide distribution. And one of the problems is fungi in general. I mean, you'd think that at this stage we would know everything about every species in the world, but we don't. It takes a lot of resources to do those kinds of things. And things like fungi in general, especially in cave environments, we don't really know much about those fauna. And this is the fungi that in particular only grows in the cold, humid environments within caves. It's something called psychrophilic, means it likes cold. And once the temperature gets above about 15 degrees centigrade, it no longer can reproduce and function. So its optimal growth is somewhere around 6 to 12 degrees centigrade. That's in the 40s to low 50s Fahrenheit. And most of the bat hibernacula sites are in the 40s in Illinois. The caves that we went to, for example, range from about 6 to 9 degrees centigrade, about 42 to 48 degrees Fahrenheit in their temperature underground. And this is the optimal temperature. And what happens is this fungi occurs on the bat When the bat goes into hibernation, the bat becomes inactive, most of its metabolic processes shut down, including its immune system, and the bat's body temperature drops from about, bats have higher body temperatures than we do, so I'm not sure what it is, but about 100 or so degrees Fahrenheit, down to the ambient temperature, which is, in the teen centigrade, maybe 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And at that temperature, this fungus now can proliferate and grow on the bat, okay? And it doesn't just cover the bat like a film. It invades the bat's tissue. It invades its wing membranes. It invades its exposed ears and facial tissues. And it degrades that tissue. And the wing membranes of a bat are, about 75% or so of the surface area of the body of the bat. So that's a large surface area for water loss, for energy problems, and it's an irritant probably also. What happens then is the bats, they lose water during the winter. They also are irritated, and they wake up much more frequently during hibernation. I know I'm rambling on here, but during hibernation, an animal doesn't just conk out in the beginning of the fall and wake up in the spring. They wake up periodically, okay, throughout, and they have to do that. We're not even sure exactly why, but part of it is to urinate, to take in some more water, to get their metabolic system just going again, to revitalize their enzymes or whatever, their neurons, and then they go back to sleep usually again. Now, if you think of the strategy of a bat that's hibernating over the winter, a good analogy would be, suppose you have a house that's going into the winter and it's going to be sub-freezing, okay? You have an oil furnace in that house with one tank of fuel. If you've got a furnace guy who can come and refill that tank whenever it runs low, fine. You can keep your house at 70 degrees all winter long. But if your guy fills your tank up once in September and that's it, he's not coming back until March or April, you've got to live on that tank. If you keep your house at 70, you'll run out of fuel, say, mid-December, end December, and your pipes will freeze, everything will get ruined. So what you do is you dial your thermostat way, way down to low. So you're staying above freezing, but you're burning that fuel at a very, very low rate because you're pacing yourself because you've got no more income.
And then you'd want to sit tight inside that house and not, like, open the doors too much.
Right. The thing is, you do have to turn the thermostat up every now and then, say, you know, and that uses a lot of the fuel you have reserved. But if you do it a certain number of times through the winter, you'll make it okay. If you double that or triple that, well, you'll run out of fuel in January or February. And that's what happens to the bats.
The hibernating bats wake up more often than usual. They use more energy. Is it actually possible they may run out of energy before the warm weather comes?
That's exactly what happens. The bats, not only are their tissues being degraded, this is even more invasive than, say, athlete's foot. People can relate that. Athlete's foot is a fungal disease. You know how that disrupts the tissues. It's doing that to the bats as well. So they're getting an irritant here, and their immune systems turn on, and they get all inflamed when they wake up and their immune system comes back. But also, it wakes them up several times more, like two or three times the normal rate. As they get up, move around, a lot of times they'll move to the entrance where it's colder because they think maybe that's going to, it feels better or something, or that makes, when you're at a colder temperature also, it slows down the speed at which you're using up your fuel. But what happens is by about mid-February to early March, the bats are showing heavy fungal growth and they've used up most of their fuel. So that by this time now, they're emaciated, they're injured. A lot of times they're coming out of the hibernacula or clustering around the doorway to it, and there's no food for them, and they starve and die.
Mm-hmm. So, and this could affect, say, if there's a whole grouping of bats, it can affect the whole colony.
Right. The fungus, we know, there's been some interesting experiments. It's hard to do experiments on this kind of stuff, but there was one experiment done up by, it was led by folks at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, where they, to demonstrate that the fungus was actually the cause of the disease, they took some healthy bats from Wisconsin where the disease hadn't been yet, and they inoculated them with the fungus, showed that that caused the disease to develop, and that none of the uninoculated bats did it, and then they could extract the fungus again from the sick bats. So it was kind of something called Koch's postulates, which is a way to demonstrate that this is a cause of the disease. And what they also did is if they separated the bats by a screen that separated them by a few inches, there was no airborne transmission. But by contact, there was transmission from bat to bat. So the fungus spreads by growing and by contact. And another thing we know about the bats in hibernation is that a lot depends on their behavior during hibernation. If you go in a cave full of hibernating bats, some species hibernate singly, tricolored bats, little tiny guys, one here, one there, one there. Others form social groups. Indiana bats, an endangered species, forms big mats of bats. There's 400 bats per square foot.
And I'm wondering, thinking of the name, are there Indiana bats in Illinois, or are they strictly in Indiana?
No, Indiana bats cover a good part of the Midwest. It just happens to be a name from where they were described.
Okay.
But this is a federally endangered species, and one of the species that actually, since we've been gating caves, has been coming back and showing a comeback. It was on the road to recovery.
But are they being struck by this disease?
Yes, they're one of the species that show the disease, and although here in the Midwest, we have not seen the mass mortalities yet out east, but only because we're on the first and second years of the spread of the disease. We anticipate it. The Indiana bats are one of the ones that's most likely to be really strongly affected, along with the little brown bats, because they do have these social groups. And another thing bats do interesting during their hibernation is they move around sometimes, and they actually do a lot of mating during the hibernation.
Uh-huh.
They'll have swarms outside the cave during the fall, where some mating occurs. But as we've been studying white nose, we've been learning a lot that we don't know about bat biology. And some people have put thermal cameras in caves to look at bats. And in a thermal camera, this is like when you see on TV, you see like an outer spacey looking view of something. And often we color code it so that the cold temperatures are blue and purple and hot temperatures are yellow or orange or red. And so when the bats are hibernating and you view this, they're all kind of like blue and purple and the same colors as the background, because that's all the same temperature and it's cold. But somebody will start arousing, waking up, and it'll turn yellow and red, stuff like that, and be bright. It'll look like somebody lit a match on the corner of one of these big colonies, and then all the ones next to it will start waking up. And then it will almost look like a controlled burn in a prairie when you see that line of fire going through it. And the whole colony will start lighting up, and everybody will move around, and some will move over to another group, and they'll split up or something. And while this is happening, a lot of times males will arouse, and they'll just go over and find a female, and they'll mate with that female during the winter. Female doesn't even arouse or wake up most of the time. Hmm. And a lot of the mating of species that occur in these hibernacula occurs in the winter as well as in the fall. And it's just kind of this process that goes on. And we didn't even know about a lot of this stuff until we started some of these investigations.
Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guest is Ed Heskey. He's a mammalian ecologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey, and he's currently involved in a study of white nose syndrome, a serious threat to bats, and it's just recently been confirmed here in Illinois. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. or post your questions or comments on Facebook or Twitter. We're on both sites at Focus 580. But get in touch with us with your questions about white nose syndrome and questions and comments about bats in general. We have a bat story from our station manager, Bob Colquhoun, emailed this anecdote to us. And he writes that as newlyweds in our first house, we were sitting in our living room. My wife was in a chair reading a newspaper. At the time, we had a pet bird, and out of the corner of our eye, we saw something flying. We thought the bird had gotten out. Then she realized it was a bat. I never knew a single sheet of newspaper could cover the entire body of a full-grown person like a tent. The bat flew around the house. It was crazy, but cool. First, I went for my baseball bat, which wasn't a good idea, and then my tennis racket. Also not a good idea. We ended up shutting off the interior lights and turning on the porch light and opening the door, and that bat flew out right away. We found out that the bat entered the house and got into the attic through a small hole in the very top of the roof line. The next day I made my repairs, but the bats made a seasonal home in the double roof eaves of our house. It was great because we were able to sit outside all summer without bugs. Bats make awesome neighbors. That's the story from our station manager here at WILL, Bob Colquhoun. And that raises up a lot of questions about where bats are and what they're doing for us. And the first thing I'm wondering, here in Illinois, where do the bats live?
Okay. Well, before I can answer that question, I have to tell you that when you ask a question like, where do the bats live? It's like there's one kind of bat, and there simply isn't.
Well, how many in Illinois? How many species of bats?
Okay. In Illinois, there's 13 species of bats. And in fact, we just discovered that there was the 13th species here last year. We didn't even know it.
What's number 13?
Number 13 is something called the small-footed Myotis, Myotis leibii. And this is like, it's a very tiny bat. It's our second smallest bat, I think. And the reason we didn't know about it so unusual is that it's a federally endangered species. It's rare every place it occurs. But it's so tiny, it crawls into little cracks and crevices and crawls under loose rocks on rock outfaces. So down in extreme southern Illinois, in places like LaRue, Pine Hills area where there's rock bluffs, biologists started turning rocks and finding bats flying out from underneath rocks on top of these things. And we hadn't even thought about looking here before. In fact, herpetologists in the southeast in places like Georgia and stuff say, oh, yeah, that happens to us all the time while we're looking for reptiles and amphibians. We turn a rock and a bat flies out. And so, you know, we're so used to looking for them in other kinds of places that this is a bat with a really kind of unique ecology to it. And we only just are confirming that it's here in Illinois just this last year.
The bat that Bob Colquhoun encountered, and I don't think that was in Illinois, but if you have a bat in the attic of your house, what sort of bat would it probably be?
Yeah, most likely it'll be a big brown bat. Big brown bats are fairly common, and they are especially prone for occurring in buildings and human-made structures. However, it could also be a little brown bat or one of the other kind of Myotis. There's about six things that are like little brown bats in Illinois. And what these things do is the big brown bats often will hibernate and spend winters in human structures and buildings also. But the little browns and stuff like that, they tend to hibernate in caves. But once the spring comes, they usually leave those caves. There are some bats that stay in caves and have summer roosts in there all the time, but most of them will come out in the spring. And then they'll spread out on the landscape. They may go 200 miles from the cave that they hibernate in.
And where do they, once the weather's warm, where do they spend the night? Or yeah. where do they sleep, I should ask, maybe yeah. not the night.
The females initially come out and form large aggregations we call maternity roosts. And these are the things that will mostly be in your buildings in the spring. They'll be in churches. I had a student working on big brown bats at one time in the 90s, and we worked on four colonies, and one was in the church and three were in schools, and they were up in the attics of these areas where bats could get in. And these were females that will congregate together. That's where they will have their babies. And then for up until, say, mid to late June, they'll be flying in and out of there every night and feeding their babies and living there. Males separate from the females, and sometimes they'll form small bachelor groups, usually smaller than these maternity groups, and sometimes they'll just stay single. And they can be in buildings and stuff also, but often they'll just be out in the woods. They especially like being under the bark on loose shagbark hickory as an example, but also just snags and dead trees that have loose bark. They like to be under things like that.
We have a call in from Ron in Atlanta, Illinois. Ron in Atlanta, good morning. I understand you have a story concerning bats and windmills.
No story, just a question. And the question, I live near a nature preserve where there's a lot of migrating birds rest. And when there was a big windmill farm going up near the nature preserve, I was concerned about the effect on birds, knowing that they run into radio towers quite often. And I thought windmills would be a lot worse during migrating time. Talking to DNR biologists as time went by here, they said, well, you know, it turns out the bird kill isn't too bad, but the bat kill is just tremendously bad. And so besides the fungus, the white nose syndrome, you know, we got this other problem with the amount of windmill farms that are going up in Illinois, that what effect they might have on our bat population, which really concerns me for all the reasons that we talked about. So that is the question. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Ron. And I'm wondering about those big wind turbines, those big white propellers that we can see in a lot of areas of Illinois now. Are they a problem for bats to negotiate?
The answer is yes. Actually, windmills, as the caller pointed out, kill more bats than birds. And we just kind of don't realize that because we're not so much aware of the presence of bats in our environment as we are of birds, and the birds got the initial attention. But the thing about the windmills is interesting is that the white-nose fungus that we've talked about, and we haven't really talked about the impacts of it on populations or what those consequences are yet, but the bats that are being killed by white-nose are usually not the same ones that are being killed by the wind turbines. People don't realize that, again, in the different, even though we have a low diversity of, ecologically of bats in Illinois with these species, some bats hibernate for the winter and others migrate like birds. We have four species in Illinois out of our 13 bats that are migratory, okay, that migrate down to more southern parts of the U.S. and stuff for the winter. Sometimes they go all the way up to Canada for the summer. And actually, the highest mortality of those migratory species occurs at wind farms during the fall migration.
So is it mostly the migratory bats which are at risk from these wind turbines?
Not 100%, but they're the majority.
Okay, just simply because they're most likely to be flying. You know, the bats which are not migrating, where are they flying? At what level are they flying?
Yeah. You know, it's hard for me to answer that.
Okay.
You ask a biologist and he'll say, well, that depends, and this depends what species. I mean, different species of bats forage at different heights and stuff. So there's actually a person at the Natural History Survey, Ron Larkin, who's actually studying movements of bats in relative to
Ron Larkin, if you're listening, please call in. The number is 333-9455.
What I can tell you is that if you count the dead bats, the highest mortality occurs during the fall migration. For some reason, not so much the spring migration. Hmm. That could be because they're moving at a different altitude. It could be because they're following a different route. We just don't even know enough about exactly of the movements and stuff of these bats during this time. We just know that they move. The local bats seem to be a little bit better at avoiding the wind tower impact. Now, the thing is, it's not like the blades are chopping them up like a fan or something. Okay, but we look at these giant winds out there, okay? And it looks to us like they're moving pretty slow. But given the scale, those wingtips, the tips of those blades, are actually moving at close to 200 miles per hour when they're going full speed. And that's pretty fast. Even so, the bats that are picked up dead are usually not bats that are clonked. We don't usually see a lot of physical trauma on the bats. What we do see is a bat might be going there, and those blades make an air vortex that has kind of a vacuum behind it. And the bat kind of gets drawn into that, and it suffers something called barotrauma, which means it's kind of like being put into a vacuum or something. It's got explosive damage to its internal organs and its lungs. So a lot of the mortality is not the bats actually being chopped up by the blades, but by passing in proximity to those blades, they may avoid it, but they get the air current, the turbulence and stuff is what gets them.
I was there was a mention earlier about, you know, how bats eat insects. Bob Culkeen in his email noted that with the bats they had in their attic, they didn't have to worry much about bugs in the backyard that summer. And I'm wondering how important are bats in that regard? How much do they eat, and what does it mean for us?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And again, it seems like it's something we should know and that we have a lot of data on. But most of the data we have is either anecdotal or it's like estimates, back of the envelope calculations of stuff. For example, Bob Culkeen called in, and I assume that he meant when he didn't have bugs, he was talking to him about mosquitoes, because that's the kind of bugs people notice up to being annoyed in their backyard. The bats that we have here do eat mosquitoes, but they don't specialize on them, and that's not even what they really like the most.
What do bats really like?
Most of the bats we have, again, it'll depend on the body size, and different bats do different things, but mostly they like moths and beetles. And actually, a lot of the smaller bats will eat some things like mosquitoes and midges, but a lot of times they'll be near aquatic habitats in the summers along rivers, and they really like emerging aquatic insects like caddisflies and mayflies and things like that that emerge from wetlands. That's why you see a lot of bats near wetlands. Part of it's for the mosquitoes and midges, but if you think about it, you've got a bat flying around out there. Imagine you're coming out and you're hungry and you're flying around, and you need to consume a lot of energy. I can talk about the energetics of a bat in a minute, but you need to consume a lot of energy. You're surrounded by objects you could grab for food. There's a bunch of cheeseburgers, there's a bunch of pizza slices, and there's a handful of string beans floating around out there individually. All right. Mosquitoes are small. They don't have that much nutrition in them. There's a lot of chitin relative to the body parts. You're going to be going for the cheeseburger, which is a moth. You're going to be going for the pizza slice, which is a June bug or a cucumber beetle or something. And, yeah, you'll take a mosquito incidentally, but that's probably not what you're going to be focusing on.
Well, and I'm imagining in terms of, you know, the benefits for us, for farmers, moths and beetles are, I guess, moth caterpillars.
Right.
And beetles are a pretty big concern. Does it make a difference for farmers to have bats around?
I guess we'll find out. One of the issues is that, again, it's really hard to decide what would happen if there were no insectivorous bats here. Okay, again, we're only talking about in this part of the country, it's all small aerial insectivores that we have. We do know from diet studies of these bats, big components of their diets include corn rootworm beetles, soybean aphids, black cutworm moths, corn earworm moths. All these things are crop pests, okay? But at the same time, if anybody who's driven a highway out here in the middle of the night in the summer and knows what's hitting your windshield knows that just because we have a lot of bats means doesn't mean that there's no crop pests.
Okay? And the question is, with if the bats are put out of commission, what do we have a lot more?
Right. And that's the experiment that no one's ever done. We never hoped would have to do by eliminating the bats, but we'll find out some more about it in the coming years.
Our involuntary experiment. I'll have another question for you in a moment. Mm-hmm. Right now, we're going to take a short break, and my guest is Ed Heskey, mammalian ecologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey, part of the Prairie Research Institute at the University of Illinois at Urbana. We're talking about bats and how bats suffering from white nose syndrome means problems for us as well. This is Focus. We're back on Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows. Bats do a lot of things for us besides provide spooky imagery for comic books and horror movies. But they're being threatened now by a disease called white nose syndrome, discovered for the first time in North America just a few years ago, then identified, as we found out once we knew what the species was, that it's in Europe as well, and just this month confirmed in Illinois. I'm talking today with Ed Heskey, mammalian ecologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey, about bats and their problems and how there are problems, too. Call us with your questions and comments about bats at 333-9455, 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or go to Facebook and Twitter and find us at Focus580. Coming up, a question from Paul on our Facebook page. Can humans move white nose fungus from, say, cave to cave or other bat habitats?
That's an excellent question. And the answer is yes, but how important is that? Okay. We assume that the introduction of the white nose fungus to North America was done by humans because it was first appeared in a cave that is visited by a lot of tourists. It's also heavily used by the caving community, who it's a nice place for them to go in and cave and explore. We know that the fungus reproduces by spores, and those spores can be in the soil, they can be in places in the environment. That's part of our study. We don't even know exactly where in the cave environment the spores might persist after invasion. And so if you sample, like, boots of visitors and stuff, you can pick up the fungus. So if you don't decontaminate your clothing and you go to a contaminated site, you could transport it to another site. And that's one of the reasons that one of the responses of managers across the country, whether it's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or the state DNRs like that, is to close down a lot of caves, especially during the hibernation season in the winter, so that people don't go in there. Not only will they not inadvertently keep arousing the bats and make them use up their energy, but they won't be also introducing the fungus to a cave where it doesn't occur already. However, I don't think people can be blamed for the spread of it right now because it's so widespread and so rapid. It's actually probably more likely being spread by cave-to-cave transfer by bats themselves.
Let's take a call. And good morning to Jeff in Geneva. You're on Focus.
Hey, good morning. Sounds like a baddie situation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, never mind. You forget.
Okay.
All right, go ahead.
No, it was just a joke. I'm sorry. It didn't fly in there like I wanted to.
We're going to be getting a lot of these in the next half hour, I think. What's your question, Jeff?
Well, my question is, this time of year, usually you don't see a lot of that, right? You know, I thought I saw a bat the other day, and I know that the geese and a few other birds are very active for some reason earlier this year than they normally are, and they don't stay around. But I was just going to tell you a story. I was in Hawaii last year, and some of the lava tubes in the Big Island over towards the Volcanoes National Park had some bats in it, and it was different kind of bat. Have you ever heard of that out there? I didn't think they had bats in Hawaii, but, you know.
Actually, I'm going to plead ignorant here that I can't tell you what species it is, but I'm not surprised because bats pretty much occur everywhere. They occur on oceanic islands. If there's any mammal that's going to get to there that's not introduced by people, like rats or goats or cats or something, it's going to be a bat. They tend to be able to colonize remote areas. And a lot of islands have endemic species of bats, like there are endemic species on Madagascar, endemic species on New Zealand that have really interesting and unique ecologies. I imagine the species in the Hawaiian bats that you did are probably similar to the ones we have here. They're either probably Vespertilionids, or which is the small family of small aerial insectivores, or they could be the family that does a lot of cave roosting, which is the ones that occur like down in, I won't tell you the family, it's Molossidae, but it occurs down in Bracken Cave and under Congress Avenue Bridge in Austin, things like that. However, all through the Pacific Ocean, there are also fruit-eating bats, but these are fairly large bats. These are bats that are, when they fly, they look like a crow, and the largest species in the South Pacific has a wingspan of 2 meters. So,
wow.
But that's the biggest one. But those bats usually don't occur in caves. They usually roost up in trees in large colonies during the days. But there's lots of kind of cave roosting bats that aren't particularly hibernating bats like we have here, but just use caves as their habitat. And it's not surprising that there were bats in Hawaii, but I can't tell you what species it was.
I never hear too much about them when I go over there. And that's what's kind of funny, because they're very protective of their environment over there. And mm-hmm. There's a lot of different things that have been brought over there by settlers in the past, so I don't think they know exactly what they have on those islands, because I've seen some strange stuff. But thank you very much, guys. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You know, I'm wondering, well, here in Illinois, the bat species that are here in Illinois, do we consider them to be native to Illinois, or have some of them come in relatively recently?
No, everything we have here is native to Illinois.
Okay, so these bats have been here for a long, long time.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, and the white nose syndrome, we haven't found that in Hawaii yet, have we?
No, it's like I said, we're on the leading edge here. The furthest south, it was just reported in the northern fringes of South Carolina and Georgia, and Illinois is probably the furthest west state, except there's some over the Mississippi River in Missouri and Iowa also.
So white nose syndrome, 2006 was the year they were first found?
It was the year that famous photo was taken of this strange fungus growing on bats, and the years immediately following that is when we started noticing the mortalities.
And so in the places they were first found, have scientists been able to record a significant real drop-off in the bat population?
Yeah, and in fact, it's frightening. Some of these, I know scientists who are bat biologists who have spent their lives studying bats in large places where they know the maternity colonies come back every year, or they go into hibernacula and do counts. And after an infection, you can have 80, 90, some places 100% mortality in these large hibernacula that have had hundreds of thousands of bats in them. That's not universal. There's some places where there's a few survivors. But in general, there's an estimated, it's estimated that as of this year, about 6 million bats have died in the northeastern U.S.
Out of how many bats would...
And that's, I can't tell.
Yeah, we don't
that's
know.
A good question, because can you tell me, like, how many birds there are in Illinois? Can you, and that's something that's obvious and easy to count.
I know
bats
that,
we just can't.
And I know they try to do counts, but yeah. Maybe bats are a little more elusive than the birds.
Yeah, they are. The only way we can really count the bats is you go to hibernacula. You're only getting some species. You're only getting some hibernacula. You're not seeing them all. And
the migratory bats.
We have no idea how many of those there
okay.
are.
Okay.
But anyway, let me just refer to that one final point. People have gone back. And on average, in the northeastern United States, where the disease has been for about 4, 5, 6 years now, there's been about a 75% drop in overall bat numbers. People who go out in the summer and do like use antibats, these things that detect bat calls, or do have been doing bat surveys at research sites or other sites annually for decades, or who have studied cave environments for decades, the overall drop has been about 75%. I think it's 73% is the numbers that I saw in a couple of papers. And some of the sites have been completely wiped out.
And we still haven't found out yet really what the ecological impact is beyond the bats as far as what they're eating and what that means for everybody else.
Yeah, one of the things that people are keeping an eye on back east is gypsy moths, because bats are big consumers of gypsy moths. And that may be something we'll see more of. But it sounds like something easy to do. The bats are gone. What's the effect? But if you think about it, in the perfect scientific world, we'd have five worlds where the bats are removed and five worlds where the bats are there, and you compare the numbers.
Hard to set up a control group for this sort of thing.
It is, exactly. But if you think about all the things that control insect abundance, yearly variation in weather is a big thing. And other life stages of the insects that are preyed on by other things. Bats are the only predators of nocturnal, night-flying insects. Okay? So
really,
they're the only predators.
Nothing else?
Well, nighthawks will eat things out there around at dusk. But everything else, most of the other birds and most of the other things that are out there hunting flying insects. Now, this is just insects on the ground that mice and spiders and stuff might eat. But flying insects are diurnal.
Interesting. So that makes the bats more key for that part of
Right. But it will be really hard to tease out the effects from all the environmental variation, especially when you haven't been counting insects for the last 20 years to get the base record.
Let's take another call. I want to say good morning to David in Urbana. David, I understand you have a question about pollination and bats.
Yes, I was wondering about what native plants were pollinated by bats. I know in the tropics many of the orchids are.
Mm-hmm. You mean here in Illinois, David?
Yes.
Is there any pollination, bat pollination, going on around here?
Of course there is.
Actually, of course there isn't. Sorry. In Illinois, all the bats we have, all 13 species of bats we have in Illinois, are in a single family of bats, the Vespertilionidae. And these are all small aerial insectivores. Their teeth and their foraging strategies are targeted at eating insects. There are lots and lots of bat pollinators, but you have to go further south than Illinois to start hitting them.
How far south?
Along the southern tier of states of the United States, you can see a lot of pollinating bats in the desert regions, particular columnar cacti, other kind of cactus, the agaves that are used to make tequila and other kinds of drinks. All those bats are one of their major pollinators.
I believe the vanilla.
Yes, exactly. Lots and lots of tropical plants, lots of spice plants, nutmeg, the cocoa plant. A lot of these things are not necessarily exclusively pollinated by bats. Insects pollinate them too, but bats are one, along with insects, of the major pollinators of these. And there are lots and lots of tropical fruits, bananas, guavas, things like that, that are pollinated by bats. And there are also lots of things that even aren't commercially valuable. A lot of, in the tropics, for example, a lot of the trees and herbaceous plants that are early colonizers of clear cuts and things are seed dispersed by the bats. So bats have a really, really important role as seed dispersers and as pollinators and stuff like that, but mostly in the warmer environments.
Is there any seed dispersing? Would some bats around here, I take it sometimes we're talking about fruit-eating bats with seed dispersing. Is there any of that done in Illinois for, you know, not as a regular basis, but maybe upon opportunity?
Yeah, I can't really see it. Like I said, all the bats we have here are insectivores, and they just don't have the dentition and things for eating fruit or pollinating.
And I'm wondering did you have anything else, David?
Yes, I was wondering if the bats that nest in holes in trees are being affected.
Yeah, and that's actually a really good question, and I'm sure there's ongoing research on that, but again, it's hard to... Some of these things seem like they should be obvious, but it's hard to detect. There are cave-dwelling bats. There are bats that like to dwell in structures, and there are forest-dwelling bats in the summer, as you're pointing out. And a lot of those will be in tree holes. They'll also just be in dense foliage, and they particularly like to be under loose bark and stuff like that on trees that have that kind of structure. And those, as far as we know, are not getting hit. And the reason is because this fungus has to be in this cold environment on an inert bat. Okay, most of those forest bats are migratory, so they're not here during the winter, or if they are, they're still kind of active, a little ones in southern Illinois. And the ones that are in those trees and stuff are mostly out there during the summer. And once a bat wakes up out of hibernation, its body temperature goes up, its immune system comes back up, and it can usually fight off the infection. So we don't see infected bats during the summers. This is only a within cave hibernating species phenomenon.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much, David. It raises the question, and I just want to remind our listeners, you still have a little time to call in with your questions and comments about bats here on Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows talking with Ed Heskey of the Illinois Natural History Survey about bats and white nose syndrome. You're part of a white nose research project now, which I take it has come up pretty quickly because you've been watching for it coming, but it's only just been recently that you've confirmed that white nose syndrome is happening in Illinois. Do you have specific things that your project is trying to find out about white nose?
Yeah, we do. Before I say that, I'd just like to give the listeners two websites, okay? First, if you just Google the Illinois Natural History Survey, or you can Illinois the Prairie Research Institute and go to the Illinois Natural History Survey under that, on the Illinois Natural History Survey homepage, right up in the right-hand corner, there's a link with a bunch of pictures, and it'll describe the research being done by our research team. It will have slideshows of what it's like to be sampling in the caves, pictures of caves, and links to a lot of other resources for you. So that's a good place to go find out some information. The other probably most important place to find out information if you want updates on the current status is to go to a website, www.whitenosesyndrome.org. That's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife site, and they are constantly updating it with new records and outbreaks and maps of the United States showing where it all occurs. And those are really good places for you to get into what's going on with white nose.
Okay. The first question is you're going to try to answer. Do you know what you want to find out at this point?
Well, our study is a collaborative study, and here at the University of Illinois, we were really, really lucky, because we heard about this disease emerging. You know, one of the big names in this disease, David Blaert from the University of Wisconsin, came and gave a seminar here on the disease, this emerging disease, a few years ago. And several of us in the audience got really interested in that. We looked around and we saw each other, and we saw we have some immunologists, we have a bat expert, we have a cave biologist, we have some wildlife epidemiologists, we have a fungal ecologist, taxonomist. We have a microbial taxonomist and ecologist expert here on campus. And we all got together as a team, and we were able to put together a team of people with all those different expertises. So some of us are collaborating with the bat biologist at the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, Joe Kath. We go out and we monitor these caves because those team members have access to the caves and know which caves are the important hibernacula. We go in, we take fungal samples off the bats, both symptomatic and not symptomatic bats. We take substrate samples and fungal samples from all different environments around the cave to look at where the fungi might be persisting in the environment. We sample outside the cave to compare the external cave fungi to the internal cave fungi, and we are characterizing the communities of the caves, which has never been done before, or is just starting to be done maybe by some other groups like us, as not reported, because we don't even know what the ecology of the microbial and fungal communities within these caves is. So we were lucky because we were able to start this project the year before white nose hit. So we have a year's worth of sampling of these caves, what they're like before the fungus hits. The fungus hit this year, and then we'll be out again next year. We have funding for 3 years at least. As the fungus invades and permeates the environment and hits the bats, we'll see how the fungal communities change in the caves. We'll see where the reservoirs we'll see what characteristics of certain caves allowed the fungi maybe to invade better than others, where it persists in the cave, and how, if there's any antagonistic species that may be, you know, native species that may resist invasion or are negatively affected by invasion. So we have a project that's not just detecting and monitoring the spread and counting how many dead bats there are. We're also looking at the ecology of the caves and the ecology of the fungi, which is kind of an interesting approach.
Okay. Well, let's go to another caller. Peter in Milford, good morning. You're on Focus.
Well, Well, good morning. This is such a fascinating subject. I've been amazed at bats since I was a kid. And I've been to Charles Bat Caverns 3 times, and I've seen the bat exit at night, and it's an amazing sight to see. My question is, we have bats, and I'm in Milford, and we're a farming community. But being a registered nurse, I'm just wondering if my cat grabs a hold of a bat with white nose or smutty nose syndrome and decides to play with it or, you know, kill it or whatever, is it transferable to other mammals yet? And what's the chance of it transferring to humans?
Yeah, thank you. That's
and
a really good
question. I'll take my answer offline.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Yeah, thanks. That's a really good question. I'm glad you asked, because a lot of people might be concerned about that. I mean, some wildlife diseases that we've had recently, for example, West Nile virus or something, had impacts that transferred over to humans. This disease does not seem to. Okay, it's a fungal disease. It's what's called a dermatophyte. It's something that eats skin tissue and stuff like that. So it's kind of like, you know, a really severe athlete's foot kind of thing. But as I've been saying, it only grows in cold temperatures and with animals with their immune systems turned off.
I'm wondering then, is it possibly something that can be transferred to other hibernating mammals?
Another good question, and I don't know. I don't know of any bears hibernating in our have.
And I don't know what else here in Illinois. Woodchucks or something like
no.
that.
No, see, the thing about this is right now, none of those hibernate in these big caves. Woodchucks, ground squirrels, things like that—they have individual burrows. Down
bats don't share their caves with anybody else.
No, not at all. There's a lot of other animals that will go into bat caves. First of all, there's all kinds of crazy, unique, and wonderful endemic cave fauna that live in there, mostly invertebrates and things. But raccoons, skunks, things like that will go into caves. Some of them will even eat some of the bats, especially if there's dead bats dropping down. Okay, so there's things that, and those things could be spreading it if they go to other caves. So there are animals that go in there. But if you have a warm body temperature and you're active, and particularly you're not just inert in a cave that's below 12 degrees below, you know, say in the somewhere in the 40 degrees centigrade, that's the temperature that the 4 degrees Fahrenheit, the temperature that the fungus likes to grow in, that you're not at risk because you're just not providing the right environment for this fungus to grow.
We have a couple of minutes left. Let me take another caller, and I want to say hello to our caller from Belgium. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes, thank you very much. The question I have is, in my shop, I get bats all the time, and I try not to damage them or anything like that, but are they subject to this? Now, it's chilly in the portions where they're at because they hibernate during the winter in my shop. But, you know, sometimes they break their hibernation. I see them, sometimes not. Do they have problems with it? Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Is in something like that, that's not a cave, but there is hibernation going on.
It hasn't been reported to my knowledge yet, but we learn things all the time, you know. As I said, this fungus doesn't reproduce anymore after... I keep thinking in my head of centigrade. I have to do the math here. 15 degrees centigrade, the high 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Mm-hmm. So the fungus campers, it also needs a very humid environment. So it needs a cold, humid environment. And we actually don't really know at this point what substrates, other than the living bats, are good kind of substrates that the fungus might live on independently of the bats. So this is all kinds of stuff we're still trying to figure out about this fungus. As far as I know, I've never heard of white nose being reported by bats occupying human structures. And if someone has some experience with that, that would be novel information.
So it sounds like this is really a moving target as far as, and I guess what you mean, there's still a lot to find out about this problem, and it could really become a problem for people in general if there really is a population decimation and if that leads to a change in the insect population.
That could be the impact for people who live in the northern temperate climates like this, like where we have all these small hibernating insectivorous bats. But what that will be, people have speculated how much it will cost the agricultural industry to lose these bats. So, for example, these are all back of the envelope estimates. People have done things like analyze the scats, the feces of bats, to find out what they're eating, and they do it a variety of ways by analyzing the contents, by DNA, whatever. They've measured in places where they've been able to capture bats when they go out at night and when they come back. They weigh them and they measure how much they're eating. They do things like use doubly labeled water and other physiological techniques to measure the energetic requirement of an active bat and what that would mean in terms of how many insects they consume. And what we know is that a million bats, it's been estimated that what was a few years ago when it was lost in the Northeast, that's probably 700 tons of insects per year. Okay, that sounds like a big number, and it is. But will the growers compensate by increased use of pesticides? What will happen with these with these things? This is an ecological kind of experiment where we can make predictions. People have predicted the cost to agriculture based on how much this number of insects of agricultural pests would both cost in terms of crop damage and in terms of increased pesticide use. And the estimates have ranged from $3.5 billion to $40, $50 billion a year for the U.S., $200 billion worldwide.
And I'm sorry, we're going to have to break it off right here, but thank you very much. Ed Heskey with the Illinois Natural History Survey, part of the Prairie Research Institute. This is Focus on WYLL.